Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Voting machines across the country are getting a workout today with record numbers of voters casting ballots in the midterm election. But the voting machines can be flawed, and cybersecurity experts have warned that our confidence in them could be misplaced. Politico cybersecurity reporter Eric Geller has been covering the issue. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
We've mentioned, you know, we talked about Texas and Georgia. Those are a couple states where there have been problems. But what kinds of problems are we talking about?
Well, there are different categories of problems when you're talking about kind of the voting technology. And one thing that's important to point out is that there are five states, including Georgia, where everybody in the state votes on an electronic voting machine that does not produce any paper record. Now, what that means is if somebody were to tamper with the systems, there would be no way of proving that that had happened because there would be no paper record that we could use as a reference point. So those are the five states that cybersecurity experts are most worried about. But across the country, there are electronic voting machines, and these are aging machines. They haven't been replaced in many years in some cases. A lot of states did start to buy new voting machines with federal money they received this year, but that process takes a long time, and new voting machines have to be certified through a very lengthy process. So what we're talking about here is an industry that is not like most other technology that Americans walk around with in their pockets and on their desks, and we're seeing the results of that.
What's old for a voting machine?
Well, that's a very difficult question to answer, only because a lot of the voting machines that are considered relatively modern are 5 or 6 years old, just because of how long it takes to get them certified. So a truly old machine, you know, could be 10 years old. And after the 2000 election, there was a real big push to start moving away from the kind of paper-based systems that produced hanging chads and move to electronic machines. That was the biggest influx of new machines. So now we're talking about replacing those systems. And in some cases, those systems are 15 years old.
And they're expensive.
They are, and part of the reason for that is that this is not a high-margin business. This is not like making a phone or a laptop. You know, you only have local election officials as your customers if you are a voting system vendor, and that means that you have to focus on selling to a small community of people, and economics says that that means that the products are not going to make a lot of revenue, so you have to set prices pretty high.
And I wouldn't want to be the person to have to pick out a voting machine. I think it's probably one super critical issue. Are they necessarily the most educated people when it comes to choosing this kind of technology?
For a long time, they have been working really hard to understand what it means to buy a good voting machine. But cybersecurity is difficult, even if you are somebody who spends all your time thinking about it, as I do. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that's a big concern, is that some of these local election officials, especially people who only do this part-time, may not have the knowledge to actually understand what is good and what is bad. And that's why you've seen the federal government really try to provide advice about the kinds of things that these local election officials should be looking for.
And when we're talking about a paper record, I want to be really clear, like the voting machines, I think the last one I remember voting on that used that had a receipt that you could see, but you couldn't touch it. It was on paper and it was a paper record, but it wasn't like I could take it out with me and show and have a receipt of how I voted.
Yeah, so there's actually a patchwork of systems. So I voted this morning. I touched a computer screen, and when I was done, a piece of paper printed out that said how I voted. I brought it over to another machine, which scanned it and counted my result. Now, the reason that that's good is that if at some point a hacker here in D.C. or anywhere were able to tamper with the D.C. scanning machines or the counts that were produced at the central office, we could open up that machine, take out that piece of paper, and see, oh, okay, Eric actually didn't vote this way, and we have proof. So that's one example. And yes, there are other examples where the paper, you never actually touch the paper, but you can look at it through a glass window.
Right. And the idea is you can't take a record of your voting away with you because that's illegal too.
That's right. This is a uniquely challenging space because we don't want to give voters the opportunity to prove to anybody else how they voted because that allows people to buy votes.
Right. What about, we've heard a lot about hacking and from foreign agents and that kind of a thing. How big of a threat is that?
It's a moderate threat, I think, only because right now, especially the Russian government knows that everybody's looking for this. And so they're focusing on a much easier and more effective strategy, which is using social media to spread misinformation. And in fact, if you ask U.S. officials, they will say that that is what they're seeing a lot of right now, just like in 2016, a real strong effort to make people believe lies, essentially, and believe inflammatory information that may not be true. And that's, of course, very easy to do because the social media companies, as hard as they try, are just not able to stay on top of it. But when you talk about actually messing with voting machines, mm-hmm. that's relatively hard. There are ways to do it. Some of these machines do use wireless phone modems to transmit unofficial results. Those can be hacked. That data does go over the internet. So there is a vulnerability there. And of course, the top concern is the voter registration databases. If you can throw people off the rolls, it won't prevent them from voting, but it will cause confusion. And if you partner that with social media misinformation, you can spread rumors, you can spread lies that people are being turned away. And of course, that starts to undermine confidence. So there are ways to do that. But everybody has been looking really hard at that over the past year and a half. And so I think, you know, and this is just a guess because we don't know, but I would say if you are the Russian government or any government, you're probably going to want to focus on social media because that's mm-hmm. much easier.
And voter registration databases, those are managed by the states, right?
Yeah, that's right. The 2000 law that basically told states go buy new voting machines, it also created a requirement that states had to run central databases so that there would be an easier way to check for redundant voter registration, but also so that you would have fewer people responsible for protecting the information.
Right. Let's hear from Russell in Canal Winchester. You're on the air. Hi, Russell.
Hey, how you doing? Would love your show, by the way. Listen to you all the way to work and home a lot of times.
Thank you.
I don't understand why we haven't evolved to the registering online ourselves and just basically voting online. I don't think it'd be no different than actually doing your taxes or doing your health, you know, insurance uh-huh. things. Why have we not evolved to be able to just do it, not stand in lines and not worry about these machines, save millions of dollars, and just vote through a secured line?
Yeah, well, that's it. Now, they do that in Oregon, right, Eric Geller?
Well, they vote by mail in Oregon.
Okay.
And you know, this is a very difficult problem. Unlike, you know, filing your taxes or applying for health insurance, once you vote and the results are certified, you can't go back and audit that. There's no agency that says, hey, we checked your voting information and we've determined that a hacker has changed your vote, so we're just going to do the election again. You know, you have people who have spent years, sometimes decades, trying to figure out how to use technology and the internet to do this securely, how to confirm that something wasn't tampered with as it travels over the internet, and they have not figured it out yet. This is not something that the experts have come around to, and if you ask them, they will strenuously recommend against this because there is not a known way of doing this that can give you the confidence that there hasn't been tampering.
And Russell, thank you for that call and thanks for listening. I always thought that voting machines were safer because they weren't online. And you're telling me now they are transmitting, granted, unofficial results, you know, wirelessly. So they are connected.
Yes, so some of them are. We don't have statistics about how many are because it's an option for election officials to install that kind of that add-on feature that allows you to transmit those results. And I should say, even though they're transmitting unofficial results, if you could interfere with the connection between that voting machine and the central office, mm-hmm. you can send information back in the other direction. And that can include pieces of computer code that could tell the voting machine, hey, when somebody votes for Donald Trump, I actually want you to register that as a vote for Hillary Clinton. And so that is possible. It's been demonstrated theoretically. We don't know of any instances where it's happened. I should also say that the computers that are used to program these voting machines are located in central offices, and they are internet accessible. They have software on them that allows you to, you know, as an election official to say, hey, voting machine, here's how you should work. Now, if somebody infects that computer, that's another gateway into messing with the voting machines. So there are a lot of indirect ways that you could do this.
So these are we're talking about right now the intentionality of screwing up the machines. But then the machines earlier, we were talking about how they're old and they have glitches in them.
Yeah, that's right. I was actually just reading a story before this program started about some issues with the poll book that election workers use to make sure you're registered. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is technology. Technology fails. And when you're talking about elections where, again, you don't have a do-over, there's a lot of attention to this, much more so than the computer problems you have at work on a regular basis.
Mm. Right. Well, plus it's only done a couple times a year, so...
Yeah.
Right. So what are the experts saying that everyday people could even do about this? Is there anything much we can do except demand that our officials make sure they get better equipment and train the poll workers?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard. I think one of the things that you can do is, you know, volunteer to be a poll worker so that you understand firsthand the challenges that they face. You know, there's been a lot of attention on the cybersecurity concerns, and poll workers, you know, are operating in a very constrained environment. There are a lot of things that we just don't let them do because, again, we are talking about elections. They can't just freely bring, you know, USB drives into the office whenever they want. There are concerns about that. And so I think that the best thing people can do is, yeah, you know, tell your local officials that you consider cybersecurity a priority, that you want them to get more money in the state budget, that, you know, you vote for people who, you know, as with every other issue, who share your views about, you know, how to prioritize this.
Is anybody still using the hanging or the, you know, the paper ballots that we were familiar with back in the day?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't think so. I think we would have heard about it. I'm not aware of any of those kind of butterfly ballots being used anymore.
And how has the field of election cybersecurity changed in the past couple decades? Is it bigger? Is it more sophisticated?
Experts do know a lot more about what's possible because they have spent, as you mentioned, several decades poking around in these machines. I would say the biggest change is that more people are aware of the problem. But one thing I want to point out is that there are a lot of players in this space. There's the researchers who try to find the problems. There's also, as I mentioned before, the voting technology companies that are selling to a very small client base. There are only really a handful of them, three of them, that are responsible for something like 80 or 90% of all the voting machines in the country. And they are not incentivized to improve their security because there, it's not a monopoly technically, but it's very close to it. And these election officials don't have a lot of other places to go. In some cases, they're also locked into contracts to actually provide technical support to these voting machines. So that's what the researchers are facing. There are these companies that really don't want them poking around in these systems. The one cause for optimism is that every other industry has adapted to this research. Early on, you know, Microsoft was very suspicious of these researchers trying to find problems in Windows. And over time, they developed a really strong process for taking in that information and actually paying people as a little bit of a bounty for finding those flaws. And so when you talk to researchers today who look at voting systems, what they say is, that's what we want. We want the voting companies to get to that point where they understand that we're trying to help.
The National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine released a report in September that urged all states to adopt paper ballots before 2020. What is the likelihood that that could even happen, even if they wanted to follow those recommendations?
So it's technically possible, but once you start looking at the state-by-state possibilities, you get into legislatures that may not actually appropriate the money, you know, give election offices the money to do it. Election offices are dealing with elections seemingly all the time. You know, there's a lot of focus on the midterms, but they also have to prepare for smaller races. They have to prepare for primaries. And then there's just the political will to actually help them do it. Will Congress give them the money to make that happen? Will states go through the procurement process of buying these new voting systems? A lot of the details there, you know, you start to add them up and it becomes less and less likely. But if everybody wanted to do it, it is certainly possible.
And how much does a voting machine cost?
I haven't actually looked at that in a little bit. I would say, you know, it's expensive. I mean, again, these machines are not the laws of, you know, supply and demand are such that these machines are very expensive because people aren't buying them very often. It's not that the components are expensive. In some cases, they're actually running versions of Windows, which you can license from Microsoft if you're a company like these. But it's expensive to sell, and so it's expensive for them to make them.
Well, let's see. Scott in Westerville, you're on the air. Hi, Scott.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
You know, this is – it's one of the most important things we can do as a voter. And I just wonder why these machines do not print us out a receipt.
You mean a receipt
that
you
voted for?
Well, we talked about that earlier, Eric Geller.
Yeah, so there's a technological problem, I guess you could say, which is that the companies aren't incentivized to make machines that do this. But then, again, printing out a receipt that the voter can take with them opens up the problems that we had, you know, in the 1800s where the mafia would try to buy your vote. The corrupt officials would pay you to vote for them. And if you can't prove who you voted for, it's just not possible to do that.
Does that make sense, Scott? Oops, Scott.
Yes and no. I mean, well, you go to the grocery store and you buy a loaf of bread and you get a receipt with all this information on it.
Right, but someone's not paying you to buy a certain kind of loaf of bread. And if someone and people used to pay for votes, it was a thing. They'd pay for votes, and you had to prove you voted for a certain thing or on a certain way, and that's why it was banned. because that's how you got, vote buying. Scott, thanks for that call. Eric Geller, I have to let you go, too. Thanks a lot for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Eric Geller is a Politico cybersecurity reporter. We are going to continue with more Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Smartphone season has arrived with Apple, Samsung, and Google all launching their new phones, but that doesn't mean last year's models don't have a lot to offer. Freelance journalist Whitson Gordon recently wrote about the ins and outs of buying a used phone for the New York Times. I'll post a link to that article at WOSU.org/allsides. Whitson Gordon joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me, Ann.
So what does the used phone market look like in 2018? I mean, are some years better than others?
Not necessarily. You know, I think it's one of those things that has just gotten better over time as phones have improved so much and there's less of a stark difference from year to year. Buying last year's model just becomes more and more enticing since you can still get it for huge discounts and it still works really well.
Where do you find used phones?
There are plenty of places you can look. You know, there are the obvious standbys like eBay and Craigslist. I myself really like to use a site called Swappa, which is a great site for buying used phones because they kind of vet every phone that gets listed on the site and make sure that it's not blacklisted by the carrier or not in unusable condition or things like that.
How do they vet every phone?
So your phone has a unique identifying number, kind of like its serial number, but and it connects kind of to the carrier, and they can see whether it's still under financing by its previous owner, or whether it's compatible with your carrier, or things like that. And that allows them, Swappa can check those IMEI numbers and ensure that the phone that you're buying wasn't stolen and then blacklisted by the carrier, or that the owner isn't still financing it and hasn't paid off entirely, which would also result in it being blacklisted, and then you won't be able to use it.
What price, how much do they cost? I mean, as let's say a 2016 iPhone, what's that going to be? What's it going to run?
So you can save hundreds of dollars this way. You know, if you're looking at an iPhone 7 from 2 years ago, mm-hmm. You're probably looking at around $300 for the 32-gig version, which is fantastic when you consider that the latest iPhones cost $750 or $1,000 or more dollars.
Well, it's encouraging, too, if you want to sell your phone to get a new one, you can do it.
Absolutely. And that's one of the, that's one of the best ways to kind of temper those big price tags on these phones is to sell your old one. You know, I know a lot of people who just keep all their old phones in drawers, and that's not necessarily doing you any good if you could sell it for hundreds of dollars.
It's not great for the environment either, right?
No, absolutely not. E-waste is a huge problem, and if we can get those phones out to people who need them and who need to save money on them, we're putting less of those electronics in landfills.
You mentioned Swappa. You also talked with Ben Edwards, the CEO of Swappa. He said buying a used phone is tricky. Is it less tricky is the point that he's saying, unless you use Swappa and then it's safe?
So it's going to be a little bit tricky all the times. Swappa does everything they can to kind of eliminate a lot of the problems with buying a used phone. You know, if you go buy a bike on Craigslist, for example, there's nothing that the owner of that bike can do later on that renders it unusable to you. Mm-hmm. But if you buy a phone on Craigslist and then it turns out that that phone was stolen or that person stops paying their lease with AT&T, your phone will stop being usable. Now, there are still things that you can do to protect against that if you're buying on Craigslist. You just have to do a little bit of your own legwork as opposed to letting a site like Swappa do it for you.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Whitson Gordon. He recently had an article published in the New York Times about how to buy a used phone. If you have a question or comment, been thinking about buying a used phone or selling one, give us a call. Maybe Whitson can help you out. This is call 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also check out our Facebook page and post your question or your comment there. How do you find out if it's carrier locked, if you have a certain carrier?
Yes, this is another kind of wrinkle in the whole system, is that, you know, when you buy a phone from the AT&T store or the Verizon store, it's locked to that carrier. Not forever.
Okay.
Just until you unlock it with that carrier. So if I go and I buy a phone from the Verizon store and then I try to sell it to someone, I need to sell it to someone who's also on Verizon, or I need to take it back to the Verizon store and have them unlock it before I sell it. And if you're selling a used phone, it's usually a good idea to unlock it first, because that widens your pool of buyers and usually will raise the price a little bit.
What else do you have to do to your phone if you want to sell it? Just get rid of everything on it, or what?
If you're going to sell your phone, you definitely want to make sure you perform a factory reset before you do so. That'll securely erase all your data so that no one can access it. And you want to make sure that you're logged out of your iCloud or Google account too, because sometimes phones can get locked to those accounts as well if you don't deregister with them with your account first.
Where do you get a factory reset done? Can you do it yourself, or do you have to get a professional?
No, you can absolutely do it yourself. You just go into your phone settings, and there should be an option under reset or general options that should just let you erase everything on the phone. And with iPhones, you can also do it through iTunes, plugging it into your computer.
What about if you want to save stuff from your phone? Would you need to buy another phone first?
Not necessarily. So both iPhones and Google's Android phones allow you to back up a lot of your data to the cloud, to your iCloud account or to your Google account. And that way, when you get a new phone, you just punch in your username and password, and it'll start downloading all of your data. It can download your apps and your email accounts and all of those things so that you don't have to go through that hassle. The one thing that you usually do need to back up yourself before you get rid of the phone is your photos. You definitely don't want to lose those, because that's not something you can recreate later on.
What are the most popular used phones out there?
So the iPhone is definitely the most popular in terms of single devices. You know, the iPhone has about around 50% market share in the U.S., and Android is kind of the other half. But there are so many different Android phones out there, as opposed to the, two or three iPhone models in any given year, mm-hmm. which means that if you're buying and selling iPhones, those are going to hold their value much better. Now, this is kind of a double-edged sword. If you're selling an iPhone, you're going to get a lot more of your money back, whereas if you're selling an Android phone, it's going to lose a lot more of its value in that first year. But when you're buying a used phone, you can buy those Android phones for much, much cheaper, because there are so many phones and there are fewer people looking for any individual model.
Yeah, I was just listening to a show on NPR about the right to repair and that whole movement out there. And it brought up the issue of people who monkey with their phones affect the ability to Apple won't work on the phone if you've already gone in and tried to repair things on it.
Yes, and that is probably one of the toughest parts about buying used phones. You want to make sure that you're hopefully not buying a phone that someone else has repaired themselves. And I wouldn't say that's incredibly common, but the best thing you can do is try the phone in person, either after you've ordered it online, check it as soon as you open it, or if you're meeting someone on Craigslist or something like that, give the phone some usability tests. You know, use the screen a little bit, make sure it feels like the iPhone that you're used to, because a lot of times these secondhand screen repairs are a little bit shoddier, and you can usually tell, hopefully, that the screen has been repaired by an amateur and not by Apple themselves.
Yeah, you think you can, but I don't know. So you get the phone. If you get the phone, from a place like Swappa or any of the other ones, and you don't want it, do they have to take it back?
No, not necessarily. And this is one of the biggest risks with buying anything used.
Yeah.
There are If you pay with PayPal on sites like Swappa or eBay, you do have some buyer protection if the phone is not as it was described. You know, if the person says, I never repaired this phone myself, and you take it into Apple and they say, no, this uses third-party parts, you might have some recourse within 180 days to get your money back.
Mm-hmm.
But there always is a small risk with buying used. And what I always say is that if you're buying a lot of stuff used, you're saving so much money in the long run that even if you do get leased once in a while and you have to buy a second phone to make up for that phone that didn't work, you're still going to come out ahead because you've saved so many hundreds of dollars on all the phones and laptops or whatever else you've bought used that I generally think it's worth it as long as you're willing to put in that little bit of extra work.
We have an email from Kim who says you can buy used phones from your carrier as well. I bought a 6S for $12 per month.
Oh, well, that's fantastic. Yeah, you know, you can buy used phones from carriers from other sites like Gazelle that do kind of those trade-ins. It's usually not as good of a deal as buying used on something like eBay or Swappa or Craigslist, but you do get a little bit of extra kind of peace of mind when you're buying it straight from a carrier.
She also wrote that all numbers are portable. Your carrier has to unlock your phone by law.
Absolutely, that's true. So if you decide you want to take your phone to another carrier or if you want to sell it, they do have to unlock it for you.
If anyone else has a question about buying or selling a used phone, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So you apply these same principles to laptops, iPads, all of that kind of stuff.
I do. I try to buy a lot of things used for a number of reasons. First, I love saving money. I love finding a good deal. That's just something that's ingrained in me. But, you know, as you said, it's also great for the environment. I like waiting until things have been kind of tested out a little bit, make sure that you know that a product is going to be good. I don't like buying things necessarily on day one when you don't really know how it's going to turn out. The reviews aren't out yet. Buying a used phone means that you get a kind of tried and true product, and you get it at a lower price. And like I said, you know, with technology these days, it's especially with phones, we've started to get to the point where last year's iPhone 8 is still a fantastic phone. Mm-hmm. And the fact that you can get it for $500 instead of today's $1,000 iPhone for something that's only a little bit behind is really a great deal.
Batteries used to be a big issue.
Yes. Batteries are still an issue. You know, a battery in a smartphone will only last a few years before it really kind of starts to degrade. But a lot, you can get those batteries replaced by the manufacturer, especially Apple has a battery replacement program. You take it into an Apple store, they will replace it for you for a price. But even with the added cost of replacing that battery, you'll still have saved money on that phone, most likely.
So do you think when you get the phone, you buy a used phone, you get it, say it's an iPhone, head to the Apple store and ask them to take a look at it?
You absolutely could, yes. The Apple store's gotten pretty crowded these days, but if you're willing to wait around for a little bit, you could absolutely take it and have them look at it. And as long as you do that within that 180 days, if you mm-hmm. did buy with PayPal, that ensures that you're going to get it looked at before that buyer protection kind of goes away.
So where would we go for other kinds of phones?
That's a little bit tougher mm-hmm. because most other phones don't have stores the way that Apple does.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could try going to a carrier store, but there's no guarantee there.
Yeah.
You could try going to a third-party repair shop and having them take a look at it and make sure that there hasn't been any moisture damage or things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, you kind of just need to buy the phone and test it out for yourself and trust that it's working well.
Just use it. If you want to... anything else that I've left out that I haven't asked you?
You know, I want to stress that it's okay not to buy a phone used. I'm not saying that this is something that everybody has to do,
mm-hmm.
but it's a really great option if you want to save some money and you know, you're willing to go through a little bit more work yourself. I get a lot of people who've read this article or have heard me talk about this and say, but, you know, I don't want to use last year's model. That's old technology. It's going to be outdated so much quicker. And with modern phones, I just don't think that is true. They do last a little bit longer because, you know, we don't have apps that are maxing out the power of these phones yet.
Mm-hmm.
And furthermore, if you're buying a phone used and then selling it again, most of these phones lose the most of their value within that first year. So if you're buying a year-old phone, you're saving a ton of money And when you go back to sell it, you're not going to sell it for that much less than you bought it for. So you're at the point where you could upgrade your phone every single year, and you're just using a year-old phone every single year, and you're still going to come out ahead.
I mean, I'm using a two-year-old phone.
Yeah,
and I bought
absolutely.
It new.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, some people would rather do that. It's less hassle to just buy a phone brand new and use it until it just kicks the bucket. That's a totally legit option, too. But if you're the kind of person that always kind of likes to have new toys to play with, buying used is a good way to do that without spending $1,000 every single year.
Well, Whitson Gordon, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Whitson Gordon is a freelance journalist. He wrote for the New York Times about how to buy a used phone. We'll have a link to that article on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. More Tech Tuesdays coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Equipped with Face ID, a new Apple Pencil, and a new smart keyboard, the new iPad Pro is the latest must-have Apple product, but it's not cheap. Joining us now to talk about that and more is Android Central writer, Arrow Wagoner. Welcome to the show.
Hi, it's great to be here.
So the iPad Pro is Apple's latest big hit. Tell us about it.
It's one of their biggest and most powerful tablets ever. It has an absolutely beautiful screen, and it has the smallest bezels that any iPad that size has ever had. But at the same time, with all of that power came a phenomenally high price tag. Even for the smaller of the iPad Pros, it starts at $800, and then it goes up from there if you want LTE or if you want a bigger bigger storage inside of it. So it's a whole lot of tablet, but it's a whole lot of money as well.
Does the price correspond with the whole lot of tablet?
Not particularly. I mean, for the most part right now, the tablet space is, you have iPads, which are all premium devices with premium price tags. You have the Surface and the Surface Pro line from Microsoft, which the Surface Go's have been getting into a more competitive price range, but the Surface Pros, the actual Surface Pros have been around the same price point or a little bit higher. But for the Surface Pros, you're getting a desktop computing experience on that device. And on the iPad Pro, it's not a desktop-oriented experience. It's not as a productive operating system because it doesn't have proper keyboard and mouse support the way that a Surface Pro or a Chromebook does, because we have Chromebooks with Chromebook tablets coming out now that you can use it just as a tablet or you can use it with a keyboard and mouse.
There's the Liquid Retina display. What's that and why does it matter?
The Liquid Retina display is an insanely high-quality display. For the Liquid Retina is something that they have been pushing for a little. Apple's been branding and marketing for a little bit while now. But for these, it's an LED display. It's an LED backlit LCD display, but it's just absolutely stunning up close. It's for a computer, you're used to using that like 2 to 3 to 4 feet away from you. Tablets are used to like stuffing up in your face while you're watching it in bed or using it on a plane.
Mm-hmm.
And so having that phenomenal picture quality matters, especially for the iPad Pro, which has always been aimed at creative, because with the Apple Pencil, you can use it to draw and create in so many different ways. So that quality is important and it's impeccable, but it's also very much out of most artists' budget.
Yeah, right. Starving artists do not apply.
No.
It does have a smart keyboard. What's that about?
For the smart keyboard, the iPad Pro has this little connector on the bottom of it to attach keyboards that have been designed for it properly, which The Surface Pro line has the same thing with the smart connectors on the bottom to power it and get the connection going, so you're not relying on Bluetooth connections or Wi-Fi connections the entire time. Mm-hmm. But for the keyboards, I don't know how many people are going to, I mean, if you're going to buy a $1,000 laptop, buying the keyboard for $100 more or something else doesn't seem terribly unreasonable. But I also have a feeling that there's going to be a fair number of people who buy an iPad Pro and just either use the Bluetooth keyboard that they already have, mm-hmm. or thanks to the addition of USB-C, you could use other keyboards with it. You wouldn't be able to use them quite as well as the one that Apple made for the iPad Pro, but you could use a whole lot more peripherals with the iPad Pro thanks to USB-C, which is something that previous iPad Pros have not had because those relied on Lightning connectors.
Is the Face ID a big deal?
I've never been a huge fan of Face ID, but the fact that it's getting to the fact that it's improving more and you're able to use it more, especially in low light situations, and it's getting more accurate. We're seeing fewer and fewer false positives with it. It is important from a security standpoint, but unlocking something with your face is never going to be quite as secure as using a PIN, a password, or even a fingerprint.
I can't get my thumbprints to work very well.
Well, for mine, it's a matter of sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. I think it has to do with how recently I wash my hands and whether or not they are, whether or not I've been in the kitchen for a while and I got wrinkly.
I just feel like I'm just old and my thumbprint's getting worn out or something. But it works fine when I want to buy something online, but it doesn't work really well when I want to do the ID part of it. Well, let me ask you this. What kind of ripple effect does the iPad Pro have on other Apple products? Is it a big driver? Do people, they get that and then they want to get the next thing?
Well, for the iPad Pro, I feel like the people who tend to buy the iPad Pro are the people who are already immersed in the Apple ecosystem. I mean, the iPad Pro, considering it does have USB-C instead of Lightning, it means that for people who have been in, who have been using a Surface or people who have been using an Android tablet, making the jump over to an iPad Pro now means they don't have to buy entirely new peripherals and charging cables immediately, which is great news there. And I really do hope that USB-C starts coming to Apple's phones as well, because USB-C is what Android is using right now. And I think, well, there aren't any Windows phones being made right now, but when Windows phones were being made, they used the same USB standard that Android did. So, and most full-size computers, the new MacBooks use USB-C. And most new Windows computers use USB-C as well. So it would be nice to have one standard cable for everything.
Yeah, wouldn't it?
Because when I travel, my Pixelbook uses USB-C, my phone uses USB-C, and my Bluetooth headphones use USB-C. So it's just bring one cable and a charger and you're good.
So who's this iPad Pro for? I mean, somebody who's loaded, has money to burn, right? What else?
Yeah. The iPad Pro this year is being aimed at people who they want this to be your only computer. And at $1,000, it better be your only computer, because I don't think you can afford another one with that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's being aimed at people who they do a lot of creating and people who are on the go a whole lot. Because I will say this for the iPad versus using like a full-size laptop or using a Surface Pro, the iPad feels like it's more travel-ready, being that it's primarily a tablet. So I think it's for people who are young, have a good job, that are able to drop $1,000 on a new tablet and want to be able to take this experience anywhere with them, because it is an amazing experience for computing and for productivity too, although not in the traditional office productivity sense. But I don't think that there's going to be a whole lot of people who are buying this just for entertainment, because while it is a great entertainment device, you don't need to spend $1,000 on a tablet in order to get a good Netflix in bed experience.
Okay, so you wanted to talk about the Samsung Galaxy X foldable phone.
We're not sure that's what it's going to be called, but yeah, the foldable phone, I think, is going to be something that also impacts the tablet space widely once we actually get to the point where we're seeing these actually, you know, work and exist and purchasable in the field. Because a foldable phone would mean that you could basically have a tablet in your pocket, because when it's in your pocket, it's small and it'll actually well, I guess for men it'll fit in their pockets. I haven't had a phone that fit in my pockets for years.
Right.
You'll be able to have something that it's compact, it's more portable, but when you actually want to, like, say you're in line somewhere or you're waiting on the waiting for the train or you're stuck on a flight, you could fold it out and start using it as a more full-bodied experience to try and get more stuff done.
How big is it?
Something we aren't entirely sure because we haven't seen any of the real, what's the word for it? We haven't seen as many real products that are foldable phones yet. It's still something that we're waiting for it to be unveiled. We're still very much in the rumor phase for the foldable phones. What was important this week was we started to see the actual the official marketing from Samsung start turning that direction because we got these little teases on Samsung's Twitter and Facebook and other social profiles where they changed their account to this new logo that was Samsung, but it was folded over. So they're finally giving a wink and a nod and telling people, okay, yeah, it's coming. We're finally ready.
Okay, and we're not, this is not to be confused with a flip phone.
No, although I kind of do miss the flip phone days. Because those were those you could at least fit in your pocket.
Yes, agreed. I agree. And I have to put those rubber things all over mine because I drop them all the time. And then you can't even just stick them, even though I just have an iPhone 7, it's hard to still get them in my pockets because there's all this rubber and stuff all over them.
Yeah, no, I've gotten to the point where I bought a shoulder holster for my phone, and one side is my phone and the other side is my wallet and keys. And in Texas, that draws a couple of weird looks, but at the same time, I'm just like, guys, they don't make tech that fits in my pockets. I had to do something.
Well, how does a foldable phone work then? Is it like a small computer or what? What do you think?
It's kind of like, think of it as like a big silicon and glass book. So you can, when you fold it in, like the inside part of the book where the pages would traditionally be, that's technically, I guess that would be the back of the phone because that's part that won't have the screen. That's where your battery and your motherboard and all that other stuff will sit. Mm-hmm. And then the two sides of the phone that are facing out, the cover will be the display. So when it's folded up, you could have a screen on both sides of your phone, and then you'll be able to fold it out and use both sides at once for a larger screen experience.
Okay, so I get it. You fold it out and you have a bigger screen. What's the market? Oh, first of all, have any of the winks and rumors included a price tag?
Oh God, no! But I'm willing to bet the first one's probably going to be. I'm willing to bet it's going to be $800 to $1,000 for the first one because you're paying for those early adopter prices. This is going to be the first one for Samsung. Will not be quote unquote the first foldable phone. We had another company that kind of rushed to try and beat them to the punch, but that's not a phone. That's not a device that most people are going to be able to buy. This one is going to be one that people will be able to buy, and that's going to drive up the demand and. Mm. People pay to be first, so I'm pretty sure Samsung is going to be looking to recoup some of their investment costs with this first phone.
And what kind of market is there for something like this? I mean, there's the market of people who always want the new thing, but beyond that?
Yeah. Beyond the early adopters, provided that they can get this down to a reasonable size, I could see this being the kind of device for people who wanted a tablet, but tablets just seemed like it was something else they had to carry around, or it seemed like it was too much bulk to try and carry with them.
Mm-hmm.
So for people who they want a big phone, but they don't want the big phone size and the big phone bulk, I could see this phone being marketed more towards them.
Is anyone else working on something like this?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. I think most manufacturers are at least working on something similar to a foldable phone at this point. I know that we've seen talk from that same line from, I believe LG, but LG would probably be working on it anyway because LG displays end up in a whole bunch of smartphones. I think Huawei might have also been working on something about that. Most manufacturers have been working on foldable phones in some respect because we've accepted that with the little glass rectangular slab, we've kind of hit a plateau. So manufacturers are looking for the next big thing to try and push the innovation in that segment forward.
Apple?
I would believe that Apple has worked on it at some point, but I don't think Apple's going to jump in. I don't think Apple will have a foldable phone ready for us in the next 3, maybe 4 years. Because if they're not even going to do a 5G phone until 2020, I think a foldable phone is something that they're going to wait for everybody else to do it, and then they're going to try and do it better.
Blizzard has announced a Diablo Immortal, coming to Android. It's a brand new Diablo game for mobile phones at BlizzCon. Why was this a thing?
BlizzCon is, well, Blizzard does a whole bunch of gaming, but the Diablo series has traditionally been more PC console gaming. People were expecting a new Diablo game, but they weren't expecting it to come to mobile. They were expecting something else that they could play on their computer, and I don't know why, but a lot of fans just don't really seem to like mobile gaming, which is weird, because mobile gaming is the easiest thing to get in. It's the easiest thing to find, and it's the easiest thing to play just about anywhere, because we take our phones everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
It makes sense for gaming powerhouses like Blizzard to try and take advantage of that market, but people were just not expecting a mobile game, so they were not amused. But it looks like it's going to be fun, although out of the biggest thing for me out of BlizzCon was all the Overwatch news, because they announced the new hero, which has just been absolutely adorable, because she's a gunslinger, and then she has this big, hulking bodyguard of a partner.
So the characters matter in this. It started out as PC, made its way into consoles, right?
Yeah, Diablo as a series is more of a traditional game series, so
okay.
People weren't expecting it. One of the Diablo games came to the Nintendo Switch earlier this year, and that was a big deal. And I think that people were either expecting the new Diablo game to start on consoles and then come to mobile consoles like the Nintendo Switch. I don't think they were expecting it to just be
You're saying. Now, it's a brand new game just for mobile gaming.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Diablo's been a big series, but they haven't done... This is their first, like, specifically, this is a mobile game, Diablo game.
Let's see. Then real quick, Amazon is giving everybody free shipping for Black Friday. That's a big deal. It's coming up and just way early this year. That's a big deal, though.
It is. Free shipping is going to mean a whole lot for people who wouldn't normally be, especially with now that the holiday shopping, like the holiday ads just bam went on the second that it switched over from midnight Halloween to 12:01 a.m. November 1st, which is great for me to play a little Christmas music, but less great for everybody else who was kind of like, I just need a moment before I start holiday shopping. But the free shipping from Amazon is good for two things. For the first thing, it means that for people who are trying to find the best deal that they can when they're shopping for loved ones this year, you might not find that in the brick-and-mortar stores, especially when more and more brick-and-mortar stores are having less availability and they're wanting you to, like, oh, come in and look at this, and then if you don't have it, just buy it from our website. For Amazon, it's a matter of giving free shipping to everyone encourages more people to shop, and it also encourages more people... once they've tried this holiday season, they're going to be like, oh, this is really nice. I think I want to buy Prime so I can have this all year.
Yeah. Yeah. Get them kind of hooked on.
But the holiday season is definitely upon us bright and early this year. Although Amazon's starting their Black Friday sales. They say they're starting on November 16th, but they've been having Black Friday early deals, quote unquote, all month long already.
Right.
And coming up next Monday, I believe, or no, next Sunday, the November the 11th is going to be a huge shopping day as well, because it's not as big of a thing here in America, but it's Singles Day, and that's going to be a huge shopping day for Asia and China, which will in turn mean tons of sales for Americans, because it's a global economy and it's a global market. People are wanting to sell to everybody, so they put things on sale for everyone.
So figure out what you want to get. Get your list together and get online. Era Wagner, thank you so much for joining us. Really enjoyed talking with you.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Era Wagner is an Android Central writer. That's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thank you so much for joining us. And don't forget to vote. That's All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.